season three of Trapo. We're back. We showed up again. It happened.
Resurrected from the shit heap we grew from.
From which we grew.
From which we grew, yes.
People don't talk like that anymore.
So let's not.
No. Oh, God, it's Masters of the Universe.
What, like the movie?
Yeah, the movie's happening right now.
About, like, 93 or some shit.
It came out, like, 87. I saw it in the theater. I was 4 years old. It's, like, the first movie I remember seeing is goddamn Masters of the Universe.
Fucking He-Man. He's with that girl from that Bruce Springsteen video. I guess that's good.
That was my Bruce Springsteen impression. I love Shane. He's an old man, but he's in great shape. Seen pictures of him recently? Great shape.
Welcome to Trapo, the show where we talk about Bruce Springsteen's tits.
Oh, he takes off that fucking tank top. You're going to see some tits. Anyway, welcome. Do we do this? Do we already do this? We introduced the show. It's season three. It's Trapo, the show that talks about stuff on purpose. He's Kai, I'm Dustin. You know, we're not going to get any new listeners with this, so it doesn't matter. We know who we're talking to. Baby. It's a season premiere of Trapo, season three. Our first and second season premieres. You may, in fact, or actually, if you click play on this episode, you saw the title, so it's already been spoiled. So yeah, there we go. It is the Essential Albums Volume 3. We're back. That's with right. More Essential Albums, Kai. It happened. I can't fucking That's believe right. it.
And it is the final Essential Albums.
This is Essential Albums Volume 3. We did it again.
We fucked around and brought it back a third time.
I mean, we do it once a season.
This season, we wanted to do something a little different. We're gonna crank it to 11.
We followed Spinal Tap's advice.
It's a top to you know, what we use on stage, but it's very special because if you can see,
yeah,
the numbers all go to 11. Oh. 11, oh, 11,
and most of
11,
the and then amps go up to 10.
Exactly.
Does that mean it's louder? Is it any louder?
Well, it's one louder, isn't it? Most blokes are going to be playing at 10. You're on 10 here, all the way up, yeah. All the way up. Where can you go from there?
I don't know.
Nowhere, exactly. What we do is if we need that extra push over the cliff, you know what we do?
Put it up to 11.
11, exactly. One louder.
Why don't you just make 10 louder and make 10 be the top number and make that a little louder?
These go to 11.
We're not going
to
double it again because that's fucking crazy.
That's like all of the essential albums in the we could have.
We're not doing a 40 album podcast. That's insane. So we said, you know, how about just one more? So okay, because this is basically a time when you think, well, maybe we were thinking we could do an episode on something like this. Are we really gonna do an episode on this? Probably not. It's the free pass. You got a list of albums you can choose. Maybe the other person, maybe they'd say no. Maybe they wouldn't want them to be in there. But you know what? This is the free pass. This is the only time you get a free pass. So if there's something you really like and you want in the canon, it feels fucking essential to you, this is it. This is your time. It's a gift, not a curse. We got the numbers in it. Apparently, our corporate sponsor just wants us to do Essential Albums podcast from now until the heat death of the universe. So, yeah.
It's all good, because now we've got 22 albums we're putting in the canon. We're going to blast so fucking high. That way the aliens can reach out and they're going to listen to this and they're going to fucking fuck so hard. So okay. You want to go first?
I don't give a shit. So do you want to flip a coin or do you just want to do it?
Have Alexa flip a coin.
Alexa, flip a coin. Heads or tails?
Okay. Heads.
Okay. Heads. All right. Heads it is.
I'll go first. First piece of this 22 installment, let's go with album that came out September 2013 called AM by Arctic Monkeys. Crawling back to you, never thought I'd call and run. Here I feel, cause I always do. Maybe I'm too busy being interesting album. It was recorded out in the desert where Josh Homme has recorded a lot of Queens of the Stone Age and Caius shit. Blues, rock, psych, stoner rock, kind of a mix of all sorts of things. Some of the songs are different genres than each other. Had a lot of hits, probably made them a lot of money. Josh Homme was on one of the songs, fucking mumbling in the background. You know, and one of the reasons I started listening to it again recently is because my My daughters actually enjoy this album a lot, and they are going to see Arctic Monkeys in 2 weeks on their birthday.
I guess that means they're still around.
Indeed.
That's the 10-year anniversary.
I think it was their fifth studio album. They were not, they're not the most prolific, and I think a lot of the members have side projects and shit. But when I was actually looking this up, I was like, wait, they only made 2 albums in the last 10 years since AM? But also, I think AM probably made them so much fucking money, they probably didn't have to, because it was pretty popular for the past 10 years. So, Tranquility Base Hotel and Casino 2018 album got a Grammy nomination. Do I Want to Know was triple platinum off AM. Quite a fucking hit. I've been listening to that album for 10 years. It's pretty good. Arctic Monkeys makes some good stuff. That's about all I got.
So it's in the canon, I guess. AM.
Unless you really don't want it there.
I don't know what you'd say. I don't give a shit one way or the other about the Arctic Monkeys. So no, it can be the canon. If it's something you really like, that's fine.
Okay.
Kind of the point of this whole whole exercise today.
So what's in the canon? AM by the Arctic Monkeys. In the Trap of Essentials canon.
Oh god, what was that? That was like a Casey Kasem thing. I'm sorry.
He's dead. Move on.
He is long dead. He is haunting. He is haunting spaceships in hell. Yeah. Moving on to my first pick. It's a little different. I don't know if this counts. From 1994, it's not an album, my first pick. It is a motion picture soundtrack from The Crow. It's The Crow soundtrack. Every line I burn, every line I scream your name. It's like the soundtrack that blew up and everyone was like, holy shit, you can put good music on soundtracks, and people who never see the movie, they listen to the soundtrack.
The original score and the original soundtrack, one movie could have 2 albums.
Whoa. It's a huge deal. I don't think people were expecting it to be such a hit. It sold almost 4 million copies. It's triple platinum. We're not going to talk about The Crow, the movie, or the James LeBar comic book, because we'll probably, and this is, we say this all the time, but we probably will end up doing an episode
That would be worth it.
So we're not going to talk about the comic book or the movie. One thing to talk about is James LeBar's abiding love for Joy Division and The Cure. Heavy inspirations for Mr. LeBar. He actually used the lyrics for The Hanging Garden, The Cure song, printed in The Crow, and he used Joy Division song titles for chapter headings in his comic. He wanted both of those bands to be represented on the soundtrack. Now, he asked Robert Smith if he could include Hanging Garden on the soundtrack. Robert Smith just said, hey, what if we just made an original song for your movie? And Bird is just fucking badass. Great way to start the soundtrack. I know a lot of people complain. See, it's not like mid-Cure or whatever. I don't give a shit. No one's phoning it in on that song. Every night I burn waiting for the world to end. Oh, fuck, there you go. And that's exactly the kind of vibe The Crow was capturing as a comic book. That was it. There's a reason why James LeBar was a huge fan of Joy Division and The Cure. Instead of including the Joy Division song, Dead Souls, Trent Reznor, Nine Inch Nails said, hey, I'll cover that. Downward Spiral era Trent Reznor, come along. It's fantastic stuff. There's a lot of bands on here you might consider one-offs. Like My Life with the Thrill Kill Cult. I've literally never heard another song from them, but After the Flesh is great. It's a reworking of a song called Nervous Christians.
There's a lot of innocent people being crucified.
It's cool also because it mixes those with like popular hits at the time, like Helmet, Milk Toast. That's on there, right? And then like Big Empty.
What I like about the soundtrack is it's not just goth. It's industrial. It's got shoegaze is definitely represented. It all fits.
They're kind of random hits, but they flow together.
A lot of the songs on here, they existed before, but they were either re-recorded for this, or they were remixed for this, or they were just covers of existing songs. And one of them was Darkness from Rage Against the Machine. Great track. Cause the innocent blood to flow. Entire culture lost in a yellow throne. Came to seek to take whatever they please. Then all they gave back was death and disease. The lyrics lyrical content is all about African colonialism and the AIDS epidemic. It was a reworking of a track called Darkness of Greed from their debut album. I always wondered if it was brand synergy because Rage was also signed to Atlantic Records, which released the Crow soundtrack. Right. And I wondered because their debut album was such a hit, they thought, okay, hey, it won't hurt if we get a Rage song on the soundtrack. That would
we already got profile. It. We don't have to pay extra for it.
I know we've talked about this before, but Medicine has a track on the album, Time Baby 3. It drives me nuts because Medicine has a cameo, like a physical cameo in the film. You see them playing on stage. You hear the song Time Baby 2. With Beth Thompson, the front person of Medicine, singing the song. But if you listen to the soundtrack, it's Time Baby 3 with Elizabeth Fraser on lead vocal. She's from the Cocteau Twins. Different song. Not as good. Drives me nuts.
Not the same.
Ghost Rider. I forgot Ghost Rider. A Rollins band. The Suicide cover. Fucking love it. It sounds nothing like the Suicide track from 1977. It doesn't matter because it's a fucking banger. I love it. The Crow original motion picture soundtrack. It's a lot of fun. Kids love it. I don't know if the kids love it. Who fucking cares? The kids love it. I love it.
Congratulations, the Crow soundtrack. I'm glad you brought that up. I'm gonna listen to that tomorrow or some shit. Let's keep it right there in that era. Album that came out in October 1995, Tragic Kingdom by No Doubt. You and me, I can see us dying. Was one of the random albums that popped into my brain, and I was like, you know, there's some songs on there. I feel like that shit is essential. Third album from No Doubt. This was still when they were like a full like ska band. Gwen Stefani wasn't like a big pop star.
I knew it was their third album, but it's just so weird to me whenever somebody brings that to my attention. How the fuck was that their third album?
Made shit before that? You know, that was still like the CD era. They thrived off the releases from this album for I think 3 years. They slowly just released a few of them here and there. Hey You, they released in February 98. So they milked that shit for 3 years. Almost all of the singles that were released, you can probably still hear on the radio randomly today. One of these songs is going to be on every hour or two for sure.
So bizarre when that occurs, when an album, it stays in the consciousness for so long, they keep releasing singles. It reaches a point with something like Tragic Kingdom where you're thinking, most of the album has now been released as singles. You heard most of the album, even if you've never heard the album.
14 tracks, and it had 7 official single releases. So literally half the album is like a radio success. The first one was Just a Girl, Spiderwebs, Don't Speak, Excuse Me, Mister, Sunday Morning, Happy Now. Those are still on rotation. And modern pop like radio and shit.
I heard Sunday Morning on Lithium yesterday.
My favorite song off this album. Fucking love that song. You came up with the breeze on Sunday. One of the random things I remember from when this first came out was the video for Spiderwebs. My neighbor had gone to hang out with his family in fucking Minnesota or whatever. And he made a VHS that had a bunch of music videos and shit on it. Spiderwebs was one of them. Music videos were the biggest thing. This shit is cool. It's just a beautiful, it's just a cool, fucking interesting album. It was incredibly successful. I don't know any of the band's other albums by name other than this one. Maybe they're good, but they're probably not as good. This is also kind of like a, kind of like Fleetwood Mac. There was a lot of like sexual drama between some of the members because I think Gwen Stefani and the drummer broke up. Oh, it was the bassist, yeah.
Yeah, it's the bassist. She didn't fuck the drummer.
Tony Cannell. They were breaking up and so her brother didn't want to be in.
You're talking about Eric Stefani? Eric. Keyboardist?
And so shit was kind of falling apart. Like one of the biggest albums of the 90s. Was being released. I thought it was also interesting. They recorded it in a whole bunch of random places. Almost every song was recorded in a different studio throughout the Los Angeles area. I don't care how they made it. It was fucking awesome. It introduced the world to ska, and then ska died right after that. No one cared about it after that. The world moved on.
And Real Big Fish just wept and wept.
Real Big Fish caught the wave, and then Gwen Stefani kept moving on and dropped the ska shit shortly after, and then became a huge pop star. And they made a couple more albums with No Doubt. So yeah, Tragic Kingdom. It's in the fucking canon.
It happened. No Doubt is in the canon. We're going to keep it rolling, Kai. I'm going to up the ante. I got an album coming out. You're never going to fucking guess what it is. It's from the year 2000. Ooh. Conan O'Brien's back. But this is an album. It's an album that you're not going to believe it because you literally just said you couldn't remember the name of it. It's 2000's Return of Saturn from No Doubt. So many girls got to stay. So many girls got to stay. It happened. Had to do it because it is my favorite No Doubt album. It's their fourth studio album, Kai. Can you believe it? First off, the idea that Tragic Kingdom sold 16 million copies. 16 million copies worldwide. It was certified diamond in America, which means 10 million copies. Tragic Kingdom blew up. Gwen Stefani became royalty. With Tragic Kingdom, she became one of the most famous people in the world because of that. And No Doubt was one of the biggest bands in the world. Insane. 2.5 years touring. They had a lot of pressure from the record label. Hey, we want another album. Eventually, they had to get back in the studio. They tried to milk it for as much as they could. Like you said, 7 singles. The last one coming out in 1998. But eventually, they had to get back in the studio. They did get back in the studio with Jerry Harrison from the Talking Heads. He produced a new track for them, a one-off called New, and that was released in 1999. It was not made for Return of Saturn. It just ended up on the album because the track ended up kind of setting a tone that they wanted to follow. Jerry Harrison did not produce the rest of the album. That did not happen. The album was produced by Glenn Ballard. Because he produced Jagged Little Pill from Alanis Morissette. That's how I remember. He got them in the studio. Then I think they ended up over time recording like 40 tracks. But they had to whittle that down. After they got it all done, thought they had a finished album, the record label listened to it and said, we don't hear a single. We need a lead single. And we don't hear it here. A lot of friction with the rest of the band because of that. Because they thought they were fucking done. And so eventually they coaxed them back in the studio and they made Ex-Girlfriend. That was born out of a lot of stress on the part of the band. The whole band was under fucking stress anyway, because how do you follow up Tragic Kingdom? You just think, oh, when's the new album coming out? Oh, you don't understand that these people are having nervous goddamn breakdowns because they just blew up with a level of success that you can't imagine, and they're trying to cope with that now. Gwen Stefani is having her own existential crisis right on the cusp of turning 30, very much thinking about her own mortality, how beauty is fleeting, conflicting desires to be a pop star and just have kids, have a domestic
life. Her love life was in the spotlight. That makes shit weird for anyone.
She just started dating Gavin Rosdale from Bush. I guess you would say their relationship was a tumultuous one. That is very much evident. Half the songs are about doomed romance. Ex-Girlfriend, you know, the lead single is very much about doomed romance. But their first track that ended up on Return of Saturn, New, is about new love and how that new love might end up destroying you. Most of the music is about this. I mean, it's called Return of Saturn. That was a suggestion from Gavin Rosdale. And this is astrology bullshit, but he mentioned to her, because she was going through all these issues, her Saturn return must be happening because she was 29, about to turn 30. Every 29 years, Saturn returns to the place where it was when you were born in the sky, and that's a time of great upheaval. So this was Gwen Stefani's Return of Saturn. Her emotions are laid bare throughout the album, and I think it's fascinating. I mean, Simple Kind of Life really does kind of hammer that home, but my favorite track regarding that is 6 Feet Under, because I just love the juxtaposition of her realization that she is going to die with the fact that she really does want a kid. Subconsciously motivated natural instinct, not the nature for the pleasure or the cycling. She wants children, but she also wants to be a pop star, and she doesn't know how to have both. And Artificial Sweetener hammers at home with the line, "I'm only sure that I'm not sure," which is basically a mission statement for the entire album. I really think, and this is, I don't know if anyone else has ever said this, and if they haven't, they'll probably call me an idiot, but I think Return of Saturn is No Doubt's Pinkerton. What Pinkerton is to Weezer, Return of Saturn is to No Doubt. After their big breakthrough album, both bands decided to get weird and introspective, and then they never really did that again, which is not a bad thing. Both albums were labeled critical and commercial disappointments. People just, they didn't want to pick up what these bands were laying down at that particular point. But I think they're high water marks for both bands. I think Return of Saturn is, I guess, a snapshot of an artist at a time and place, kind of an artist in flux. And the band was almost crippled by their own success at this period of time. And Return of Saturn as an album is them sorting themselves out, which I think is great. It went double platinum, I think. And no, actually, I guess it only went platinum. They sold less than 2 million copies, which is a huge disappointment. But the fact of the matter is, anything after Tragic Kingdom would have been labeled a disappointment. Rocksteady came out a year later, sold 3 million copies. So they got back on the horse and started making, honestly, more commercially oriented music. But I like Rocksteady, so I can't complain. I'm glad that Return of Saturn exists. I'm actually glad that it exists as an anomaly in their career, because that makes it more special. But
especially
New,
after all the success of Tragic Kingdom.
But New is one of my favorite songs of all time. I just adore that song. It throbs and it makes me happy. I'm done. What's next? What's next, Ty? It's in the canon. Return of Saturn is in the fucking Trapo Essentials canon now.
Who the fuck knew a No Doubt double feature was coming tonight? We didn't. It was a surprise as shit. All right. Let's keep it in the year 2000. I'm going to pick the third studio album from Eminem, the Marshall Mathers LP.
When I was just a little baby boy, my mama used to tell me these crazy things. She used to tell me my daddy was an evil man. She used to tell me he hated me. But then I got a little bit older and I realized she was the crazy one. But there was nothing I could do or say to try to change it, because that's just the way she was. They said I can't rap about being broke no more. They say I can't rap about coke no more. Slut, you think I won't choke no whore till the vocal cords don't work in a throat no more?
That's his third studio album?
Technically. The first one was essentially not really. It was like an EP. I would really call Slim Shady LP his first album. There was some other shit that came out, but it was like underground shit. I wouldn't count that. It came out 2000. It was a huge fucking hit. It sold like 25 million copies. 11 times platinum. Best rap album at the Grammys and all sorts of shit. Made Eminem a household name with lots of these singles. And for me personally, this was one of the first like hardcore kind of rap albums that I listened to growing up, a white boy in the fucking country. As Titus would have said, this was something that was like commercially available and became popular, something that I was able to listen to. And also there's a bunch of weird fucking storytelling, horrorcore kind of fucked and strange, and that was kind of the first time I'd heard someone telling their own life like a horror story in music, I suppose, in general, but especially in rap. Like, oh shit, was that a nightmare? No, that's probably pretty close to what he went through. Oh, that sucks. Fucking interesting, strange album, and I fucking love it. Bunch of weird, fucked up shit in this album. Opened my eyes in a lot of ways, because there was all sorts of things I'd never fucking heard someone say in music before. He mentioned Columbine, and like, you weren't supposed to talk about some of that shit at the time. Things like that were very taboo and over the top, offensive on purpose. Partially just to see what the fuck would happen, but also because that's who this dude is.
Is that the one with Amityville in it, or is that the Slim Shady LP?
Yeah, I think that was Slim Shady LP.
Yeah, okay.
Oh, no, it was this one, yeah. Barely ill from Amityville. Accidentally kill your family still. Thinking he won't,
goddammit, he will. Barely ill from Amityville. Thinking he won't, but goddammit, he will.
The Way I Am is probably my favorite song. Oh, it's just lyrical content. The song guilty conscience has gotten such rotten responses. And all of this controversy circles me. And it seems like the media immediately points a finger at me. So I point one back at him, but not the index or pinky or the ring or the thumb. It's the one you put up when you don't give a fuck. This is who I am. Deal with it. I like that attitude. Marshall Mathers LP. It's in the fucking canon, folks. I felt like we needed a little more rap to kind of even out some of the other shit we put in the canon.
You were talking about music that opened up your eyes and got you thinking about new ways to appreciate music. That's what the Marshall Mathers LP did for you.
Indeed.
I got an album that did just that for me. You know who made this? Because I talk about him sometimes.
Tell us.
It's 1992's Grand Guignol from Naked City, which is a John Zorn joint. Together for very long. This is their second album.
What's it called?
It's called Grand Guignol, named after the Grand Guignol Theater in Paris. It's a theater that specialized in showing very lurid plays. Often they had graphic violence. The Grand Guignol is the second album from Naked City. Technically, the first Naked City album is the title of the album is Naked City, but it's credited to John Zorn, even though he had a full band at the time. He just hadn't called the band Naked City yet. But John Zorn is a guy I've always liked. He's an American musical composer. He's a conductor. He's an arranger. He's a mixer. He's a producer. Taught himself to play the alto saxophone because he hated the idea of being a composer who would sit in a booth, you know, let the musicians have all the fun, basically. So he wanted to be in the trenches with these guys making the music. He's a guy who, by his own definition, deliberately resists category. And music isn't static. It's a living thing. And it can be whatever you want it to be. I didn't know that until I started listening to John Zorn's music. I'm like, wait, it can be whatever you want it to be. Whenever you want it to be something else, it can be something else. From moment to moment, music can change. It can become whatever the fuck you want it to be. John Zorn is a musician who thrives on experimentation and collaboration. That's his life's blood. And one of the things I always appreciated about John Zorn is that he's the guy who kind of puts his money where his mouth is. He was hired by Walter Hill to produce a film score for a movie he was directing called, I think it was called Looters. His music was rejected. Walter Hill thought it sucked, hated it. It did not make it into the movie, but he still got paid. And he took that money and used it to establish his own record label, which is called Tzaddik, which means righteous. Basically, it's a label applied to righteous individuals, and so it takes on that term. I just think that's really cool. He decided to basically create a record label called Righteous. He makes music that can be whatever he wants it to be. He does not like to be pigeonholed into any one category. If you had to kind of push him in one category, it would be a general jazz thing, I guess, but he goes so far in different directions with most of his work that even calling it something like that is completely reductive. He established Naked City in 1988 as what he called a compositional workshop because he wanted to test the limitations of the rock band format. He had a bass player, he had a guitar, had a guy on keyboards, a guy on drums, he had a vocalist, he was on the saxophone. He tried to make a rock band and then to see what he could do with that. And he was also very much into hardcore punk and grindcore. With these influences and also with his love of jazz, country, traditional composition like classical music, he kind of went hardcore with Naked City and just decided to make, I don't know how you would categorize it. I don't know how you would. It's confrontational. It's music that kind of assaults you. It is jazzy. It is classical, and at times it is beautiful. He perfected a format he calls the hardcore miniature, which is a song that lasts from 20 seconds to a minute and a half. You don't just get one. You get a series of them. It's like a machine gun burst. That's what he does with Grand Guignol. The first several tracks are, aside from the title track, which starts off the album, they're all based on classical compositions, and they're beautiful. They're all done in his own particular style, but they're beautiful works. And then there's a track called Blood is Thin, which is the first hardcore miniature. As soon as you reach that, it goes off the fucking rails and you basically descend into hell. It's gorgeous music to me, and I love it. There's 41 tracks on Grand Guignol, and most of it is assaulting your senses, and it's gorgeous. And I think it's a wonderful thing. Oh! that's my favorite album for them. I like John Zorn. I think he's a fantastic and innovative man. He's a genius. I'm not going to say Naked City is his crowning achievement. I don't think it is. It's gorgeous music. I like to listen to it. I mean, I listen to Grind When You're Old at least once or twice a year. It's fucking nuts. It gets your blood pumping at the very least. Like, you want to go on a run, you'll feel like you're running from fucking demons. I love it. Grind When You're Old, Naked City, 1992. It's in the fucking canon. Nice. And you can't take it back.
Speaking of weird ass experimental music that we're putting.
One day I'm going to get you to listen to some John Zorn. I have to.
Maybe I'll listen to this one. I don't know.
I listen to Grand Guignol from Naked City and tell me how much you hate it. I want to know. I just want to know.
Okay.
This is something I have to stress. This is music that when I was first exposed to it, it helped me realize music was a world, not a world, but a universe of worlds. One of those formative musical works that opened my eyes and showed me that music can be fucking anything.
Yeah.
And I've been thrilled in recent years to find other works that have hit me in a similar way. Like, we've talked about it before off mic, but Lyra Pramick's work. That's the kind of stuff you listen to where like, holy shit. And that's all done with a voice and a computer, and it's immaculate. I love it when we find something that pushes the envelope and shows you that, no, we have not found the edge yet. Music can be fucking anything. This is that music. Grand Guignol, specifically from Naked City and John Zorn, was one of those foundational works for me. I didn't mean to interrupt you. I'm sorry. Keep going.
You mentioned people, bands, music that creates its own universe, creates its own niche, and also something that you mentioned, experimental and sometimes often collaborative. One of the bands that showed me that, but could also be within a rock band format, was a band that I know you personally hate, and that is Primus.
Oh, I don't hate Primus. I don't want you to get the wrong idea. I just, I had a hard time getting over them feeling like they were a novelty act. That's all. I know that they're not. I mean, you have to admit, in their heyday, when we were kids, and you watch some of those music videos, and they look like live-action cartoon characters, and the music is so overwrought, you're like, this is like some Weird Al shit. It's not. I don't want to feel like I'm saying bad words about Weird Al. Weird Al's a fucking genius with what he's done.
No, but it's kind of the same feeling where it's like, if it's not your thing and you just kind of glance at it, you're going to be like, oh, well, this is just a fucking joke. And that's it.
No, but I've gotten over that. It's one of those things. It's like a childhood thing you have to kind of outgrow because you have to see it through the eyes of an adult. And seeing Primus through the eyes of an adult, I can get past that. Well, I'm still not a huge fan, but I definitely respect Les Claypool as an artist because he is the shit he can do is phenomenal.
Indeed. So one of the reasons I picked this particular album.
Oh, did you mention the name? I didn't hear the name.
Oh, I didn't. So I'm going to pick 2011's Green Naugahyde. Please pass on, clean steel fibers can be a hilltop drive into an auto mall, but no one's built over me. He's never been none quite like Clint. There's really only one Clint. But I really did like Lee Van Cleef. I sure didn't really like you. Whatever happened to Lee Van Cleef? Whatever happened to Lee? Not one of their most popular albums by any means. Overall, it showcases what Primus best could be. Some of the earlier albums like Frizzle Fry and Antipop, they have a couple good songs, but then they have a bunch of weird shit that could be very off-putting, like you were saying with John Zorn. Like, if you're not really fucking into this, some of the shit is fingernails on the chalkboard grating to your ears. I could totally understand that. But I think this one flows and it creates its own kind of weird fucking world. Also, there's a bunch of weird references. One of the main singles was called Lee Van Cleef, and that's where the title came from. Driving in a yellow Studebaker with Green Naugahyde. This album was just fucking weird. First album they'd made since 99. Think
it was a long break.
There was a long break. They released some other random shit, but Antipop in 99 was their previous. They had released a couple other EPs and shit, but they weren't really full albums. I'd also seen them on tour during this time in Wichita, 2011, 2012. Les Claypool started out by saying, sorry, the show's not going to be as loud as it normally is because we couldn't fit all the speakers in here. There's a show going on. There are giant props. There's some weird shit. Les Claypool's in some weird-ass outfit. There's some weird gimmicky shit going on. The concert that I saw, he had these giant inflatable, they almost look like the Moon Man from the MTV logo, the MTV Awards kind of logo. But his face was a green screen that constantly had different faces projected on it depending on what song was playing. Les Claypool's face just looking completely fucking psychotic, but looking down on the audience. Fucking giant beings looking down on you while this weird ass music is just blowing your fucking mind and probably your eardrums. So even if he couldn't fit all of his speakers in, it was pretty fucking loud. It's okay that you didn't get the rest of them in. This is also the only Primus album that had Jay Lane along with Les Claypool and Larry Lalonde. Primus is just some weird shit. Some of the songs might sound like rock music, and like you said, some of them may just sound like a kishy fucking joke, but there's some cool, interesting fucking music on here that I just really enjoy. Also like Lee Van Cleef. I sure didn't
really like him. You like the actor Lee Van Cleef?
Yeah. Whatever happened to Lee Van Cleef?
He died a long time ago. He's a dead man. Les Claypool is not dead. Of course, we just dated the podcast. Eventually, he will be dead.
Fuck yeah. Primus. Green Nagahai. It's in the fucking canon. What else you got?
Congratulations. I'm sure Les Claypool is going to be thrilled when he hears this news. We'll fucking send him an email.
Oh my god, I'm in the canon?
Yeah, you're in the canon, Les Claypool.
What canon?
It doesn't matter.
None of this matters.
A big one.
Oh, it's the biggest one because this shit's going to space. Aliens are going to listening to Lee Van Cleef tomorrow night. We have to build the canon first. It's a whole thing. We got to get permits. Okay, so next, we're going back. We're going to rewind the clock a little bit to the year 1997. You know it, you love it. Everyone remembers 1997, right? Except for people who weren't born in 1997, of course. That makes me sick to my stomach. There are people born after 1997, full-grown fucking adults with kids of their own. How did that happen?
I was at a job, and this kid was like,
I was born in 1992.
I was like, I remember 92. Oh, I think I'm old. That's what time is going on without me? It's horse shit.
And now you're 40.
It was like, now we're happened? 40. God damn it.
The next album on the Trapo, I don't know the fuck, the Trapo Essentials hit list. We're going back to 1997. This is pre-Dreamcast, baby. It is the fourth studio album, Canadian singer-songwriter Sarah McLachlan. It's called Surfacing. Me happy. I love this fucking album. Came out in July 1997, released to coincide with the inaugural Lilith Fair that Sarah McLachlan co-founded.
Oh, that's right.
She'd grown disillusioned with touring and with the male-dominated touring world. And the year prior, she started her own tour with Paula Cole. That was a huge success. What if we tried to pursue this as like an actual thing, like just female artists and female-fronted bands? We actually tour with this female-fronted festival. But it was a phenomenon when it started. Anyway, look, Surfacing reached number 2 on the U.S. Billboard 200. It actually was, I guess you call it a blockbuster album, octuple platinum, and it doubled those sales worldwide. To date, it is her best-selling album of all time. She's never topped the success of Surfacing. She won Best Female Pop Vocal Performance at the Grammys for Building a Mystery. I don't know what I'm supposed to say about... I mean, look, Angel, we talked about Angel at some point, because you told me that DMC listened to it and it saved his life.
Yeah.
You listen to Angel, I get it. That could save your life.
That's what you need at that time, it could.
There's some poignant shit in that song, really.
Don't make no difference. Escape one last time. It's easier to believe in this sweet madness. All this glorious sadness that brings me.
That's good imagery. I know Angel has become that song that everyone associates with the sad dog commercials for like the ASPCA for good reason. It's a song that makes you want to donate to the ASPCA. You hear the song coupled with images of sad dogs shivering in the snow.
Yeah.
You want to give money so those dogs don't shiver in the snow anymore.
Whatever sad shit they're showing when you play that song, you probably want to give it. So it's a good thing she wasn't like willing to just whore it out to anyone. She only lent it to the one thing that she was really passionate about. If she'd hoarded it out, man, they could have used that for some real nefarious shit.
But she was inspired to write Angel because she'd read an article in Rolling Stone about artists that had succumbed to heroin addiction. And it's not necessarily in a religious context. She's not preaching to you, even though it's called Angel. You're in the arms of the angel. May you find some comfort here. Sure. But it's not necessarily from a religious context. It's just a song about empathy. Building a Mystery is was the lead single. That was a huge hit on its own. It's a song about facades people put up. They try to be cool. But really, when you can find that right person and you can feel like you can actually be yourself, even if you're damaged, you're fucked up, you can still find love and be together. My favorite track has always been Adia. I always just like the song. That's really powerful sentiment. For the longest time, I just thought it was a song about someone trying to reconcile with a friend or a lover, which it technically is. I've forgotten that I'd actually watched her VH1 Storytellers. Remember those VH1 Storytellers? Great stuff that was back in the day. But when she was on Storytellers and she performed Adia, this is something she doesn't like to talk about. She talked about it there. She'd ended up having sex with and then later kind of starting a love affair with her best friend's ex. And that fucked her relationship with her best friend for at least a year. To this day, apparently, they're still best friends. They reconciled, but Adia was basically trying to come to terms with a betrayal that she perpetrated upon her friend, trying to make up for it. So there's actually a lot of heavy emotion behind that I didn't expect when I first heard it. The wonderful thing about most of the music on this album, and about most of the music that Sarah McLachlan composes in general, is that it's vague enough. You can project your own emotional state and your own baggage onto it.
Right.
Which is one of her real tricks that a lot of people underestimate. Sweet Surrender is a good track. Solid track. And she was inspired by Leaving Las Vegas, of all things. The motion picture Leaving Las Vegas to write Sweet Surrender. Which I found to be this beautiful and tragic love story of these two people who were rather pathetic, both in their own rights, yet completely accepted each other for who they were. All the beautiful things, all the ugly things. Accepting ugly things and being able to appreciate the fact that someone can love you for all those nasty things, especially when you think you're completely unlovable. There's some great comfort in that. A specific phrase a critic leveled against her, monumental banality. That's just incredibly unfair because you don't like her music. But guess what? It doesn't matter if you like her music, random critic, because surfacing is in the fucking Trapo Essentials canon, so eat a dick. You can feel. It's okay to feel.
I think my next pick is going to be second album from Tool called Einema, around 1996. Kind of wrote a couple of single releases for several years. Thought it was funny, Stink Fist is their first single. What's the big single off your second album gonna be? Keep Yeah, this shit debuted at number 2 on the Billboard charts. It was a pretty good-sized hit. Eulogy 46-2, Hooker with the Penis.
That's the one people keep calling My Shadow 46-2. Actually, St. Vincent, she was doing she was doing one of those fun videos when she goes through some of her musical influences.
I've been crawling on my belly, peering out what could have been. I've been wallowing in my own confusion, insecure delusion, for a beast to cross me over, peering out what could have been.
I mean, also including which is a fucking recipe to make the eggs of Satan.
Yep.
In German. It's like, what the fuck is this? I don't know. And then Push It starts, and it's like 10 minutes of fucking rock jam. It's just it's a great fucking rock album. Weird, interesting turns in some of the music. Maynard does what he does. He doesn't really sing a lot. It's just kind of yelling.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know about that.
Obviously, Maynard can fucking sing. That was one of the complaints about some of Tool's early stuff. Maybe that's just because people need something to complain about. Einema was the first Tool album with Justin Chancellor, who I believe was on the rest of them, is the bassist. Yeah, apparently Einema is a combination of anima and enema. Anima meaning soul.
He's starting over with a clean soul and a clean colon. Cleanliness is next to godliness.
And God is empty.
Just like me. That title track's just the best, though. It's such a bitter apocalypse.
I'm praying the tidal wave. I want to see the ground give way. I want to watch it all go down.
It's so sneering and cruel. It's like, I'm ready for it all to end.
Yeah, let's ride that tidal wave.
You know, if you're in a certain mood, you listen to the title track. Yeah, that's it. That's all I need.
Hey, Einema won a Grammy for Best Metal Performance.
Not the same year that Jethro Tull beat Metallica for Best Heavy Metal Album, right?
Yeah.
What a middle thing. And I'm happy about it. I'm not mad.
Right.
Fuck them. Should they have been nominated for that? No. Jethro Tull should not have been nominated for that, but they were. Fuck you, Metallica, just in general. I'm sorry, I'm getting weird and confrontational when we're talking about Einema, which doesn't fit.
And now it's in the canon.
Great, we're gonna go back. We're gonna take the Wayback Machine and go back to 1995. I had to do it. I had to go back and pick the third studio album from those old-time American alternative rockers, the Smashing Pumpkins. It's Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness. That's right. Shit went diamond, baby. I mean, this was a double album. That's kind of unheard of. Wait, you mean double album? It was a huge seller? Oh, yeah. Melancholy and Infinite Sadness blew the fuck up.
That was probably the first double CD I bought. Plastic fucking case. You'd knock somebody out with that shit.
That was the first album I bought. That was number one. Melancholy and Infinite Sadness. Bought it at Best Buy. When I was a kid, I didn't buy a bunch of music. I didn't buy music. I didn't give a shit. This was the first thing I'm like, this is it. I gotta pick this up. I listened to it, like, this is fucking amazing. I can't believe it. This is what music should be, my friend. Had 5 singles, man. We got Zero, Tonight Tonight, Muzzle, 33. Was it 1979? That's 5. I can count. I hate to be like, oh, well, you know, it was a huge commercial hit, so, but no, I mean, who gives a shit? It's a masterpiece. Oh, yeah, I like to pick the weird choices. No. Sometimes you want to listen to something. It doesn't matter if everybody else likes it. Sometimes everybody else likes it because it's just fucking great. Their second album, Siamese Dream, they toured for like a year. Everybody kind of wanted a break. Billy Corgan was like, we need to get right back in this shit. He'd reached an epiphany. He thought, you know what? I think we're done as a band. What we're doing is boring. And we need to treat whatever we do next as the last Smashing Pumpkins album, because it's probably going to be it. Rock and roll might be dead. I don't fucking know. So we got to make something big. He got ambitious. He's thinking a double album. He was thinking the White Album, Beatles self-titled. We should do something like that. He used the term the wall for Generation X. That's what he wanted Melancholy and Infinite Sadness to be. He didn't want to just keep doing what they'd been doing because he was done with that. He got rid of his producer. Butch Vig was the name of the producer of the first two albums. He felt they'd grown complacent with him.
If I remember right, he's one of those old school producers who's like,
you got a hit, let's crank that shit out.
He wanted to go in a different direction.
If it works, let's make the fucking money.
He went with the producers Flood and Alan Moulder. Bringing in new blood at this point kept everybody on their toes. I think you know a lot of the stories involved with the Smashing Pumpkins back in the day before this. Billy Corgan was a bit of a tyrant. I'm not going to get into all of that. I don't want to. That's speculation. That's gossip shit. I also just don't want to get into the nitty gritty of that. One of the things that did occur with the production of Melancholy was that Billy Corgan, he made a concerted effort to not be that guy. And the producers also tried to help create a better environment for everybody to contribute better to the whole, to feel like they were actually doing something instead of Billy Corgan coming in later and saying, no, I'm going to re-record that. Now, you fuck that out. I'm just going to re-record that. And that too. So I'm going to do everything on the fucking album. Thanks for nothing, assholes. No, right. This time around, everybody contributed. One of the things that, if you read between the lines, makes a lot of sense. The producers came along and said, let's use two recording studios at the same time. We're going to have Flood and Billy Corgan hang out in Studio A, and we're going to have the rest of the band, Alan Moulder, hang out in Studio B. You separate Billy Corgan from the rest of the group, there's no friction. Flood and Billy Corgan are doing their own thing in A. Alan Moulder is guiding the rest of the band B. So you don't have those immediate arguments between him and everybody else. So it's separating the problem child from the rest of the group, which I don't want to say anything bad about Billy Corgan in that respect, because if you listen to Siamese Dream and Gish, well, it's great. So he clearly had something going on there. But, you know, Billy Corgan tried not to be, you know, I'm all saying, as big of an asshole. And whatever happened there worked. Because they managed to create a 28-track double album. There's so much going on musically within. There's 1979, Tonight Tonight, 33, We Only Come Out at Night.
So that VHS I mentioned earlier where my friend had brought back and Spiderwebs was on it. The video for Tonight Tonight had like just released. So I had just seen that for the first time along with that Spiderwebs video. They were maybe back-to-back or maybe those are the only two I remember. I remember seeing that shit and be like, whoa. Oh, this is some weird shit. This is something different, trying to make something fucking interesting here.
Yeah, and you get a full orchestra with Tonight Tonight, which really does add to the romance and the grandeur of the entire thing. The song itself, it's perfect. And the music video, which is based on the work of Georges Méliès, is also perfect in its own way. And it won, it had to have won the Video Music Award, right? The MTV Video Music Award. It had to have won like all of them. It had to win all of them. But the whole album works so well together, even though there are so many different musical styles involved. I still don't know what the fuck is going on with Cupid the Lock. I don't know what that is. I want Cupid's arrow under you. I don't know what's happening with that track, but I love it. We Only Come Out at Night is just bizarre. I love it. What I like about the music, it keeps you on your toes. And that's exactly what Billy Corgan wanted. That was his mission statement. This shit cannot be one thing. If this is the last album we make, we have to go all out. That's exactly what they fucking did. It's been, at this point, 28 years since this album was released. I mean, like when you get to the end of Tonight Tonight, he says, I think it's gorgeous. It's still, honestly, to this day, it's one of my favorite things. I think it's almost unassailable. It's the wall for Generation X. We're millennials, technically, but it works for me. Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness from the Smashing Pumpkins. It's a masterpiece. Fuck you, it's in the can.
Let's go back to 1972. I'm talking Neil Young. I'm talking Harvest. Did she wake you up?
Talk about harvest.
No. Fresh off some serious success from Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young, Neil Young wanted to do something else. And so he made a fucking country rock record called Harvest. I believe it was a pretty big hit right off the bat. Heart of Gold is still a pretty big hit today. Some residuals off that shit every fucking day. It has some of his most famous songs. Heart of Gold.
Heart of Gold.
Old Man.
Old Man.
The Needle and the Damage Done.
The Needle and the Damage Done.
Which is a great fucking title. Title track, Harvest.
Harvest.
Old Man is one of my all-time favorite songs. I liked it when I was a young man. I like it now that I'm an older man for different reasons. It's written in such a way that you can feel it when you're young talking about an old man, and you feel it when you're old talking about you. So it's like the song doesn't change, but you do, and your perspective changes, but the song makes you think about that shit differently.
I remember when I was 24 and I heard the song. I'm like, hey, you said 24.
24 and there's so much more.
24 and there's so much 24 more.
24 and there's so much more.
But now I'm 40. I'm like, can it end? Is it over yet? I guess I feel old, but fuck yeah, I'll listen to the song when I'm 60. If I make it that far, we'll see. I'm a lot like you. But yeah, you know what? That's true. I remember that. I remember that feeling. It's funny because you mentioned old man. Feelings of old man from both points of view are really encapsulated by a film called Wonder Boys that was directed by Curtis Hanson, based on a book I'd read before. This movie came out, and Michael Douglas is in it. He's a star, a teacher at a college, at a university. One of his students is named James Lear, and he's played by Tobey Maguire. Both these characters go on this kind of bizarre journey throughout the movie, and there's a moment, you got the needle drop from Old Man. It hits like a freight train. Depending on when you see that movie, at what point you are in your life, from the young man or looking at the old man, or the old man looking back, because it hits two different ways. I would recommend anybody watch Wonder Boys. It's a wonderful movie. Watching Wonder Boys is the thing that made me really take notice of the song Old Man. I know what that's like. I can be the old man looking back saying, I'm a lot like you. I was 24 once, but you haven't been 40, so fucking listen to my wisdom, whippersnapper, but never mind. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
That's exactly what I was saying. It's got that interesting ability to go both ways, make you introspective from different perspectives.
Still alive. I'm not dead yet.
Still making music.
He's still sticking with his beliefs. He has not sold out. He is a man who stands by his convictions. I respect the hell out of him for that. Is Harvest in the canon? I don't remember. Is it?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, Neil Young's Harvest has officially been inducted to the Trapo Essentials canon, children.
Motherfuckers.
That's the end of part one of our two-part, what do you call it? The two-part Trapo Essentials season 3 premiere, whatever it is. And look, we have a blog. Once you go to that blog, tell us what you think about the music we've talked about thus far. Speculate about whatever the fuck music we're going to talk about next. Traposhow.blogspot.com. That's traposhow.blogspot.com. Go there, comment, say all the words. It doesn't matter. We don't matter.
None of this matters.
Our email address doesn't matter. That's for sure. Trapo.show@gmail.com. If you want to send us a long-winded diatribe on how much we fucking blew your mind with these album picks and what you think might come next, let us know.
In the meantime, we'll be back next week. With part two of our Essential Albums season premiere. It's two parts because we talk too much. But, I talk too much. And in the meantime, it's time for you to just get the fuck off the internet until next week when you're going to listen to part two. Bang, bang, bang. Son of a bitch had to go and take a shit. His pants are just full of shit right now. He couldn't help it. He couldn't control himself. Did you know that Masters of the Universe, 1987's Masters of the Universe, was not a box office hit? Did you know that? I don't even mind, really, that it all took place on Earth instead of Eternia. It didn't even bother me when I was a little kid. I was 4 years old. What do you want from me? There's no nuance in a four-year-old's mind. I just accepted it. It's Masters of the Universe. How could it have ever been good? Based on a fucking cartoon that was made to sell toys that already existed. What the fuck did you want from this movie?